The following presentation was recorded at the 2010 Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute. More information at thedocforlearning.org.
Good evening and greetings in the name of the Master Teacher. So you already know I know how to complain. I did find it very hard to say no to Brother Allen. Not because I thought I was qualified or anything like that, but he's sacrificed time more than once to help me out. And so I told him I had a hard time saying no to him. Keeping everyone informed, interested, and involved in the work of the school. I don't know how long it took them, the committee, to come up with that title, but I think it's well-worded and very concise. I mean, it says a lot in a few words, and it's got proper sequence, too, I think. Keeping everyone informed, interested, and involved in the work of the school. As the first word indicates, or hints, that it takes effort, keeping. To keep at it. It takes effort. And even if you have accomplished it, it can be lost, right? Keeping. I guess one more difficult part of this type of topic is something that Marcus kind of alluded to earlier in the afternoon. What chapter and verse do I use to talk about school boards keeping everybody involved in the school? I just don't have that book of Hezekiah in my Bible. That was mentioned this afternoon. But I did think of a man that was exceptionally successful in getting everyone involved in a project. And that's kind of what I want to look at tonight as a starter. And although keeping everyone informed is something that takes a lot of effort, keeping them interested, effort, involved, more effort, it's something that can be lost. It's not something automatic. It's like, if you look at the book of Proverbs, the getting of wisdom. It just doesn't hit you with a bolt of lightning one day when you're in a moment of neglecting your duties or kind of lazy. It's something that takes effort. And I want to encourage you with a phrase that you may not believe to start with, but I hope to convince you throughout the evening. I want to say that although it's not something automatic, some takes a lot of effort, it's as easy as pie. Some of you may be already shutting down your ears to the rest of it because I'm not talking about pie in the sky, something you'd like to have, but it's just out of reach. It's some unrealistic enterprise. I'm talking about something else, which I think you will understand. Open your Bibles to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah was an interesting man, and I'd like to take his example as how to get somebody informed, interested, involved in a work. Now, this was not a work of school, but it was an important work. Begin reading here in verse 1 of chapter 1, the words of Nehemiah the son of Hakaliah. And it came to pass in the month Chislu, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the palace, that Hanani, one of my brethren, came, and he and certain men of Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. And it came to pass when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. And I said, I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and terrible God that keepeth covenant and mercy for them that love him and observe his commandments. Let thine ear now be attentive and thy eyes open, that thou mayest hear the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee now, day and night, for the children of Israel, thy servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. Both I and my father's house have sinned. We have dealt very corruptly against thee, and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the judgments which thou commandest thy servant Moses. Remember, I beseech thee, The word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if ye transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. But if ye turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out into the uttermost part of the heaven, yet will I gather them from thence, and will bring them into the place that I have chosen to set my name there. It's chapter 2. It came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Xerxes the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not beforetime sat in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid, and said unto the king, let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad, when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Then the king said unto me, for what dost thou make request? So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me into Judah, and to the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. The king said unto me, being also sitting by him, for how long shall thy journey be? When wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. It goes on to say how he requested letters from the king to be able to have wood from the forest to build the gates and so on. Jumping down to verse 11, so I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days, and I arose in the night, I and some few men with me, neither told I any man what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, neither was there any beast with me save the beast that I rode upon. And I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, into the dung port, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Then I went on to the gate of the fountain, and to the king's pool. There was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then went I up in the night by the brook, and viewed the wall, and turned back, and entered by the gate of the valley, and so returned. And the rulers knew not whither I went, or what I did, neither had I as yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work. First thing I have here, first point, is personal interest. How did this man show his personal interest? Well, he showed it in various ways here. I'm going to look at a few here. Personal interest. He took personal interest in these defenseless individuals in Jerusalem. No wall to protect them. Today it's not the Jews in Jerusalem. Today it's the school children. Do they have the protection that they need? Is there a separation there between them and the unholy? I asked someone here this morning what they do in their school. I've asked a number of people that. What they do in their school to keep people informed, interested, and involved in the Word. His first reply was, oh, being interested personally. Oh, that's what I saw here. The life of Nehemiah. Personal interest. He showed that personal interest by inquiring. Private inquiry. First of all, private inquiry. Verse 2, chapter 1. I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped. I don't know exactly how this all happened. Josephus writes that he was at the palace and he heard some people outside the wall. And so, what a dad, Schwitzer. They were talking Hebrew and caught his attention. So he started asking questions, found out where they had been. So, this referring to him as a brother, this man that he names in verse 2, may not have been a blood brother, may just have been another Jew. But first of all, there was that inquiry. He showed interest. He had personal interest, and so it was private inquiry there. But that followed with persuasive intercession. He pled with God. He fasted. This was heavy on his heart. He was sad. He cried. He took it seriously, didn't he? Why should it bother him? He had a good job, didn't he? But he was interested in those people over there and what would happen to them. So there was persuasive intercession here. He reminds God of his promises. He reminds him that even after they're scattered, God had promised that if they don't obey him, he would scatter them among the nations. That is already fulfilled. But now he's reminding God that he had said that if they would repent and serve him, then he would gather them again to that place, regardless of where they are. The uttermost part of heaven. So there was persuasive intercession here. And as mentioned earlier today, that prayer doesn't do it all. Sometimes there's an interruption. We need to get up off our knees and do something. Moses had to get down off of the mountain because his classroom was misbehaving. You see something about that here. Prayer in Shushan the palace did not build a wall in Jerusalem. It prepared somebody's heart, but it didn't build a wall. Next, I see premeditated ideas presented to the king when the king asked those questions. Why do you look sad? What's going on here? You're not sick. And so he had thought through this thing if there would be an opportunity, what he would ask for. So the premeditated ideas here. And I think he kind of played on the emotions of the king even when he mentioned the sepulchers of the ancestors. Because for the ancients, that's something very, very serious, to disturb the ashes or the remains of an ancestor. So he mentioned that several times here in his discourse with the king about the city of his fathers and his sepulchers there. And then when he did get there, he made a personal investigation of the needs before he ever went farther and talked to anybody else about it. So there was a private inquiry that proved his personal interest. There was persuasive intercession that proved his interest. There was premeditated ideas, and there was personal investigation of the needs. Why all this effort? Why did he risk his life to do that? Why did he go make this dangerous journey and go to a place that had enemies that did not want him to do what he wanted to do? Wasn't the palace a secure place? He had personal interest in this project. And so, with the homework done, we continue reading in chapter 2, 17 to 20. Then said I unto them, ye see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, and we be no more a reproach. Then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's words that he had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. But when Sembalat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant of Ammonite and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king? Then answered I them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore we his servants will arise and build, but ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. Beyond personal interest, I see that he's giving something here. He wasn't just rattling off a bunch of dry facts and some statistics that from his studies, 90% of the cities that have 75% of the walls down are more likely to be attacked than others that have walls or something like that. Everything he said here had a purpose. He wanted to get the message to them, and he wanted them to do something about it. So, first of all, purposeful information to those that should get involved. Problem identification. Don't you see the distress we're in? And I imagine there were some that said, sure, we've seen it for a long time. Tell us something new. We can't do anything about it. The walls have been down for many, many years. Well, we know they were down for 70 years before the first group returned. And some think it was 40-some years. Some think it was 90. Some say it was 60-some years, and some say it was 90 years before Nehemiah got there. So if you add those together, these walls have been down for a while. The stones are still lying there, but it's been that way for a long time. He identified the problem. And then he publicized intentions. And he mentioned what God had done for him, what the king had said, and he published to them his intentions, why he's there, and some powerful insistence. They said, after he was finished, let us rise up and build. They had information now. And they were ready to get to work. The president that was in office when I was born used to have this saying, leadership is the art of getting someone else to do something you want done because he wants to do it. Understand that? Leadership is the art of getting someone else to do something you want done because he wants to do it. In other words, you have something, a project in mind, but you need to convince somebody else to get busy. And in this case, it's not that he just wanted to get somebody else to do it. He was willing to help. In this purposeful information that he gave to the people, we mentioned that problem identification and stuff like this to the people that should have become involved. But what about the people that were trying to stop the work, the outside critics? He also had some profound insight there. Profound insight. He said, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. And since they were not of the children of God, we have no portion or right and memorial in Jerusalem. They were not part of the group, and they didn't have any right to say what he could and could not do, or how he should do it or should not do it. So beyond personal interest, we have purposeful information. And we see that Nehemiah didn't just come there and say, the king sent me, this is my business. Now you're supposed to obey me. In chapter 3, we see that they really got busy. It says, who built what part of the wall and who built beside them. I think about the only negative thing in this whole chapter 3 is the last part of verse 5 that says, but their nobles put not their necks to the work of the Lord. I think the priests and everybody were busy building this wall. And they got the idea they can do it. And there was a spirit, a healthy spirit there that moved them to work. But it wasn't just that Nehemiah said, you do it. There was personal involvement, personal interest, purposeful information, and personal involvement. He was right there with them. In chapter 4, we can see that he had quite a few problems. It seemed like everything was starting to come to a standstill at once. He had his enemies causing more problems, and the people that were working got to the point where they said, we can't do it anymore. Verse 10, chapter 4. And Judah said, the strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed, and there is much rubbish, so that we are not able to build a wall. And their adversaries said, verse 11, they shall not know neither see till we come in the midst among them and slay them and cause the work to cease. That's the way it happens. When things start going wrong, sometimes it's usually more than one thing that goes wrong at a time, right? But I think Satan was working here to try to get this Nehemiah discouraged, get him back where he came from. But in this personal involvement, I see he's a panic inhibitor. He got people to stop and think. Verse 13, therefore set I in the lower places behind the wall, and on the higher places I even set the people after their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and rose up and said to the nobles and to the rulers and to the rest of the people, be not ye afraid of them. Remember the Lord, which is great and terrible, and fight for your brethren, your sons, and your daughters, your wives, and your houses. And it came to pass when our enemies heard that it was known unto us and that God had brought their counsel to naught, that we returned all of us to the wall, everyone unto his work. It takes some prodding of individuals. Prodding individuals with reminders of God, long-term results. Remember your children, your wives, your houses. Prodding individuals is not easy work. You've heard it said that some people are like wheelbarrows. They're not useful unless they're pushed, and any little obstacle easily upsets them. But as long as you're pushing, something happens. But the work was slowing down. You may have an idea what it's like. You're building a wall. Rebuilding is even harder, maybe, but building a wall, if you get up as a mason, get up so high, it's fairly easy. But then you have to set up your scaffolding, and you have to get more effort to get all your stone up there and all your mortar up there. It's just a lot more work. And besides, they probably had to dig deeper in the debris to find the stone they wanted, because the first ones were on top that they had used. It was easier to get to. Stones have been there for many years, and it was discouraging work. You can imagine it was hot under the sun, and then the threat of the enemies coming and killing them while they're at it just didn't help any. So there had to be some prodding with these individuals. Sometimes our patience is tried with someone's slowness, and sometimes it seems like it's getting slower and slower. The work was slowing down, and he had to do some prodding. You say that Abraham Lincoln, as a young man, took some grain to a miller by trade. And this man was noted for being very slow and very lazy in his work. He was not in a hurry. And Abraham Lincoln was apparently in a little more of a hurry. And so he had to say something. So he said to the miller, "I think that I could eat that grain as fast as you grind it." The miller said, "But how long do you think you could keep it up?" And the future president said, "Until I starve." Apparently, he thought he was going slower and slower and slower. Notice verse 15. All of them, back to the wall. Everyone into his work. That's the word we have up there, that second word in the title. Keeping everyone involved and informed and interested. Everyone was back at the job again. There were programmed instructions in verses 19 to 20. You stand here, half of you have your swords, half of you are going to be working, and the ones that are working are going to have the sword girt on their clothing and be ready at a moment's notice to fight. And they didn't have cell phones, a lot of electronic gadgetry, so since they were working all around the city, they said, "Wherever you hear the trumpet blow, you get there and help us. You blow the trumpet here, we're going to come help you. You blow the trumpet over there, you went over there. That's where the enemy's going to be." So there was instructions. 21 and 22. "So we labored in the work, and half of them held the spears from the rising of the morning till the stars appeared. Likewise, at the same time said I unto the people, let everyone with his servant lodge within Jerusalem, that in the night they may be a guard to us and labor on the day." That sounds like a lot of work. Work all day and be on guard at night. "So neither I nor my brethren nor my servants nor the men of the guard which followed me, none of us put off our clothes, saving that everyone put them off for washing." The only time you take off your clothes is when you take a bath. This for almost 2 months. It's a lot of work, a lot of effort. So we'll say pillow ignoring. You get the idea? There were precautions introduced in chapter 4, but the work kept on. This personal involvement shows here in verse 23 that I just read. In chapter 6, when the enemy was trying to get him to come have a meeting with them outside the wall, verse 2, chapter 6, that Sambalat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, "Come now, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono." But they thought to do me mischief. Oh, no. "And I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, and so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you?" Personal involvement. He was not going to leave the work. And hopefully, school boards never have to come to what he did in chapter 5, where then there were punishments inflicted, penalized injustices, people charging interests, people are supposed to be working together and involved in the work, cheating each other. That's no good. You're getting the idea, aren't you, when I say it's easy as pie? Sounds good. But what we really want to know is how to do that today, right? So you want some more pie? Practical illustrations. This is what some people are doing. I'll give you a list of some things that people are doing amongst our churches. And by no means is it an exhaustive list. You're probably doing some things that aren't on this list. But I'll mention a few. Some that you may not be doing and may want to try, and something that may spark more ideas. I suppose in most of our schools, if not all of them, we have a weekly session or where when a brothers, fathers, or pastors come in for a weekly devotion. Sometimes this is Mondays, sometimes it's Wednesdays, sometimes it's Fridays, depending on which school. Sometimes, like in Faith Mission, we have the fathers coming in on Monday mornings, I believe, and on Wednesdays we have the ministers having chapel. Usually that's done by turn. The minister would do it for 1 month, and another minister would do it for another month. I think this year we're including fathers of children or students who would not even be of our church, at least in some cases there. But I know some churches have even the youth boys, the ones that aren't married, come in and have devotionals too. That can be a routine, and you'll find, if you're a teacher, you'll find that some students really enjoy some of those moments, and there's also some that are a bit dry. And so if there's some pointers that can be given by the school board as to how to do it to make them all more interesting, that would be nice. When I taught school, the last term I taught in Indiana as a youth, before I was married, every week on Monday morning, the school board would come to school and walk around the classroom and observe. We had the ACE, individualized system at that time, so the star chart was one thing of interest, of course, and some other things. And they'd walk around and see the progress of the students, and then they'd sit down at a table with us teachers and have a devotional with us. That takes a lot of time, but it's very nice. In another school, there's a young man that gives Bible classes for the upper grades. I think that's once or twice a week. There's also one school that I talked to the chairman of the board. He said that as a board, they give a paper or a reminder to the families. Each family that has a child in school, at least, has a turn. Every week, somebody comes to school from the family, parents, to visit school or do something for the teacher. It can vary. You can bring lunch for them at school. You can invite them to your house for supper that week. You can send them a card. Show some form of appreciation for what they're doing. Encourage them. That's a weekly family taking a turn. Each week, a different family. And in that same school, the school board members trade off and do the same thing. 1 week it's one brother on the board, does it? Another week it's another one. They do something for the teachers. Maybe they come and teach a class for them. They do something with a certain group of students. Not the same thing every week. Another thing that I think a number of churches are doing, and that is have a special evening, a school emphasis, just at least once a year, have a plan, a program to give emphasis on this Christian school. And, again, do something with that vision. Show the importance. Keep them informed. And in our church, we often do this maybe within the month before school starts. But it can be done throughout. It can be done at a parent-teachers meeting. I think something like that happened at Virginia Beach just last night. You can get a speaker in from another place to speak about some aspect of the school. And or you can just have someone locally do something. There's different things like that you can do. One chairman of a board told me that he tries, he doesn't quite get it accomplished, but he tries to visit school every week. That doesn't have to be a long time, but he walks through the schoolroom, and he usually takes little cards, and he has a Bible verse on it, and he drops his card off at each student's desk. Not that they have to memorize the verse, just gives them something to think about for a couple moments, something to encourage them, and the reason he doesn't do it the same day every week is because he feels that if he goes the same day every week, they're going to expect him the same hour, go in different hours of the day and different days of the week to get a more overall picture of what's happening at school. It's a good idea. It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, but I think he's doing a very good job. I remember something in my school days, an older man, well, I always thought he was a lot older, but found out later that he was the same age as my dad. But he always had gray hair, as far as I can remember, very bald, and he walked with a limp. I guess I always thought he was 5 to 10 years older than my dad, but he really wasn't. In fact, I think he was a few months younger. But he was a, I guess nobody's a born storyteller, but he was almost like that. Some people say you're not born anything, but he had a gift for storytelling. And our teacher, thankfully, would often, when this man would come to school, he would cut back on some classes and just let the man talk for a couple hours to his children. And he held us spellbound with his stories, especially the stories of long ago when he went to school, how things were when he was a little boy in school. And I remember one thing he said, that when an airplane flew over, everybody went outside. School was dismissed for a couple of minutes. Everybody ran outside to look at this airplane. Well, we lived close to an airport, right behind my dad's farm. The school was close to the airport, and there was continuously airplanes flying across. If we would have done that, we wouldn't have gotten any learning done. But that was the difference in time. He also told us about some kind of disease he had in his leg. That's why he was limping, because from the knee down to his ankle, he only had one bone instead of two. And he told us that story. He was a boy, and he needed to be taken to the doctor, and he was quite heavy and had to carry him, which was very tiring. You know, all these details are very interesting to little children. And how that one day he was out, and he was supposed to let the sun shine on his leg, so he had his leg exposed. Then one day he felt something kind of funny in his leg, and he looked down the bone, and he saw something moving, and he called his mom, and she came, and here there were some maggots and inside his bone. His bone was exposed, part of his leg, and they didn't know what to do, so they took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, well, you just leave him alone. They're just getting all that dead, bad flesh out of there, and once their job's done, they'll leave. And they did. He had to endure a little bit of wiggles during that time. All those things are very interesting. And if our teacher would have never let him talk to us, I wouldn't know those interesting details. Something to do. I'm not sure how much that supports the school, but it makes it interesting. Mothers. Some mothers take turns, especially in younger classrooms, and they come there and help them with some reading classes, oral reading, or they help the children with Bible memory. It's a big help to the teachers. If they have somebody coming in, the mothers are taking turns doing this. I think it's a weekly thing. I remember in school, too, one of the ministers would come and give music class. Instead of having one of our teachers give the music class, he would come and give the classes. And he was a gifted singer. He loved to sing. And he sparked that interest in us to sing. And he had a very hard time expressing himself behind the pulpit, but with a songbook in front of his hand, he did an excellent job. And that was where his strength was. And he got people motivated for singing. Later, my sister-in-law gave some music classes at the school. You can have people coming in and give an art class. At one school, there's an older man that comes in every Tuesday morning and has something for the upper graders. And the same Tuesday morning, a mother comes in and has something for the fourth to sixth graders every Tuesday morning. I think one of you mentioned to me that the night before school starts, you have something special for all the parents to try to get all their interest again and get the idea of school promoted a little more. At Faith Mission, we have, the later years, we have something special. The morning school starts. All the parents are invited. Anyone cares to can come. The school board is there. And there's a devotional. And each of the school board members gives a little speech. And then there's some coffee or donuts or something special afterwards. And usually something else. Either we have a special gift for the children to get them started on the year there, something they can have in their office or their desk, or a couple times we've had somebody come in with balloons. A brother in the church has balloons in the basement with helium, and they write their names down and the address, and they go outside and they all let go of the balloons at the same time. We stand and watch the balloons go up. Then it's time to get to work, and mom and dad go home, the students go to the classroom. It started on New Year. Interest in the school. You can have brethren come in and give vocational training if you want. Maybe somebody has a woodworking shop and they want to have a little project with the older boys. That's something that can work. Maybe somebody knows something about refrigeration and can give a little some pointers on how refrigeration works. Or a little welding, or something like that. This year, our school, there's a few girls taking a home ec class, and there was a sister that helped them with the section of the cooking, and we got the benefit of that because the school board was invited to an evening supper at the school, and we were served a good supper by these girls who were taking this home ec class with the help of the sister in the church. Cooking and baking. The sewing that goes along with that. I think the school got some new curtains this year because of that project. Somebody helping them, teaching them a few basics on sewing. Field trips. If you can, get the parents to give you some ideas as to where to go. Have some contacts. And you have to check things out beforehand, make sure it's going to work, but I don't know that the school board would have to make all those decisions. I think they could delegate a few of those things too sometimes, but it has to be done on time, and more people that are involved, the easier it is if we can coordinate everything. Brother Nathan mentioned this morning something very sad that happened in our school. It happened 10 days ago. A mother came, picked up her children, and left and hasn't come back. What do we do? What can we do to help them? What can we do to help the school? Because it has its effect on the teachers. It has its effect on the students. And so the chairman called me up the other night and said, this is hard on the school emotionally. Teachers are suffering. What can we do? He has a suggestion. What would I think about it? And so one of the school board members bought a few bouquets in town on Tuesday, some cards. Wednesday night we had a men's meeting. So after the men's meeting we signed some cards. We put a bouquet in each classroom so the students and the teacher could see that the next morning. I don't know. That didn't solve the problem in the home, but I hope it helped ease the pain at school. What can we do? Well, we can say they're not from our church. Somebody else's responsibility to see what happens there. But I know our deacon's been there talking to the man and appreciate that. I remember when I was teaching. One girl was in the ACE system, they have their different levels, they achieve so much a week, so many tests. If you do this and that, and don't do this and that, don't get too many demerits and things like that, get on the highest level, you have the most privileges, and so on too. And there was one girl that was continuously on the highest level. School seemed to be easy for her. She loved it. And all of a sudden she had problems. She just couldn't get work to. And Mama said, it's because she's got to the level in her academic level and her chronological level. She had explanation. You know, she's got to the point where she just can't do it anymore. She has to be satisfied with a low level. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was Mom and Dad decided they were going to separate for 6 months. So Daddy was at home. What do you do? Do you just tell the mother like that? That's not the problem. Here's the problem. Well, 6 months. It started back in the 70s. We're still like that today. Remember it. This girl had a very tender conscience. It hurts me the most. She messed up her life. She ended up following. I don't know how old she was when she found out that her daddy that left home wasn't really her father. She became a mother before she was married. That's what she's living with, the third husband. Yeah. Third man she's with. It could have all been avoided. Things that happen in school, but I'm not giving you much help. I'm just talking about problems here. Keep going. Financial involvement. How do we help get the money together? There's also that kind of support that we need. We need to have interest in the school, or people won't get involved in pulling money out of the pocketbook either. And so, what can we do? There's different ways of doing it. There's schools that work with tuition only. There's people that work with free will offerings only. There's combination of the two. Quite a few schools that I'm acquainted with, I think, would say that the children from the home church as a school would be paid for by offerings at the church, but anybody outside the church that's sending from another church or neighbor that's sending a student would be charged a tuition. Some do it, they have a family rate, each family pays so much. That hardly seems fair to the ones that have one child in school and somebody else has five. Why do you need to pay as much as they do? Or if some schools have a student rate, and that puts a heavy burden on the ones that have a lot of children in school. So some have a combination, a family rate plus a rate per student. And some of our schools have a cap. You pay so much more for each student, but after the third student, if you have four or five, you don't pay any more. That's kind of the ceiling. So it doesn't get too heavy on some families. So there's a number of ways of doing that. In Costa Rica years ago, I remember there was a time when there was quite a few youth in the church that were unmarried, but they had jobs, they were earning. But some of the parents in the school had a hard time coming up with the money, and so it was. Information was given at a meeting. It cost so much to run the school, to pay the teachers in this curriculum. It cost so much per year. And so we have so many students, it's going to cost this much per student per month this year. And then ask the parents, how much do you think you can give? And the parents would say if they could pay for all the children or not. And there were some, of course, that were not paid for. And so other young boys in the church that were not married helped out. Grandpas in the church helped out and helped with that. Sometimes you divide the money per student, or you can divide the money per working man in the congregation. There's different ways of doing it to get people involved. I think one thing that has helped at our school, too, and as far as our Sunday announcements get sent out to us by email. Sunday afternoon we receive the announcement. Our deacon puts on an email everything that was announced in church Sunday morning. And that gets sent out. So the membership that would have been absent for some reason wasn't in at the time the announcements were given can find out what the announcements were. And it helps to remind them what the announcements were if they did hear it. But it also, he has an addition there that says, tomorrow morning, Brother so-and-so is supposed to have school devotions. Next Monday morning, Brother so-and-so is supposed to have school devotions. So it's a reminder. It gives you a couple months ahead, a couple weeks ahead of time reminder that it's going to be your turn to have school devotions. And it helps, I think, to avoid the forgetting problem. Instead of having a school board member always talking to or calling these brethren every Sunday to remind them, it's right there. They can read it. There's other things that are done. I'm not saying you should do them or should not do them, but there are annual auctions. There are consignment auctions. There are bake sales. There are car washes. And I know there's quite a few Amish communities that have fish fries annually to raise money for their school. And I'm not sure how to feel about all these activities. Some fundraisers, I think, okay. I think we should try to keep the D in that word. Let's turn to something else. But I have one problem that I see in some of these things that I fear could become a problem. It doesn't have to be, but is the mentality coming into us that we cannot let go of money for school unless we receive something at an auction, or receive some service or some food or a stomach or a shinier car? Do we have to have something back before we can let go of our money? That's what I see as a negative about these options. The positive I see is community involvement, people coming together for these occasions, which you may not meet too often otherwise, and it gives exposure to more of a community effort and multi-church effort maybe. So those are things that some people are doing, and I'm not saying whether you should or not. So we've talked about a few things tonight. Personal interest, that showed private inquiry, persuasive intercession, premeditated ideas, personal investigation of needs, and had purposeful information with problem identification, publicized intentions, powerful insistence, profound insight in responding to the enemies, personal involvement as a panic inhibitor, prodding individuals, programmed instructions, pillow ignoring, precautions introduced and penalized injustices. You notice I'm spelling pi without the E. Sounds good. How easy is it? I said it's as easy as pie. Well, I didn't say it was easy. I said it's as easy as pie. I've given you a lot of pie. I don't know how many pieces of pie you like when you sit down and eat pie. But if I would have said something is as easy as standing on your head on top of a fence post for 5 hours, you would have known that it's not easy. But it's as easy as. So I tried to. I hope you didn't have an overdose of pie tonight. We did have this thing here in front of my face, and there's speakers here, so I didn't serve any ice cream with the pie. But in pi, we use pi in mathematical equations to figure out the formulas to, when you talk about the area or the circumference of a circle or sphere, cones maybe. We can use pi when we talk about the vibrations of a string or the swing of a pendulum. We use pi for these formulas. And I like to look at it tonight as the pi that we need for the formula of our sphere or circle of involvement in the school. The other thing I like to think of is pi, according to the Encyclopedia, pi is an irrational number. Now, what does that mean? It cannot be written as a simple fraction or a decimal with a limited number of decimal places. It goes on and on and on. You can go for millions of places, and there comes out even. And the first number before the decimal point was a 3. So I also like to kind of play these games in my mind that this pi figures into all this, relationships, all that we're working here. We need pi. We need God, the triune God, with infinite resources to help get the interest, involvement, information. But that's not all. There's more pies that you need to pull in at the right place. You need to punch in at the right time. You need to plug in and be informed. You need to put in all your strength. You need to pitch in. We had a brother last week in our church that said that our strength will never exceed our vision. Think of that. How's our vision for the school? How much strength do we have to spend for the school? Our strength will never exceed our vision. Nehemiah said it a little bit different in chapter 8, verse 10. He said, the joy of the Lord is your strength. So tonight, I would like you to keep on pitching in and doing all you can to promote this. I know it's not easy, but he kept on. Nehemiah kept on until the project was installed and stated, or inaugurated, whatever you want to put there, the last piece of pie. But my prayer is, as I look over this group, is that there be many Nehemiahs here, and may the joy of the Lord be your strength.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.